Welcome back, one and all. We're going to have another go at this. This is Season 12, Episode 2 of the Ubuntu Podcast. This week, Mark is going to be telling us about his new streaming box, whatever that might be, and there's a filthy rumour we've got some command line lerv coming up as well. So to discuss that and go over your feedback, I have Alan.
Hello, hello.
Good evening. Are you well?
Yes. I've got a beer and that's good.
That does sound good. What sort of beer have you got?
It's from the Hogsback Brewery and it's called Tea, and it was a birthday present. Yeah. So I just cracked that open. It's delicious.
Somebody really loves you if you've got pint of tea for your birthday. And of course, Mark.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm not bad at all, thank you.
What have you been up to recently?
I have been playing Elite Dangerous.
Ooh.
That's clever, because you game on Linux.
I do game on Linux, and it is clever.
So how did you do that?
I saw the game on sale for the princely sum of £7 on Steam. So I thought, it's probably worth buying that and see if I can get that to work with Proton. So I had a quick search on ProtonDB and found several people saying that it was gold rated, which means it works perfectly, possibly with a bit of faffing. And I read what faffing was involved and tried it out, and it didn't work. And then I reread it and tried it out properly, and it worked.
Okay, so was this black belt level faffing you had to resort to?
No, it was black belt level paying attention to what you meant to be doing, but then it's like run three commands.
What essentially did you have to do?
Right, so I had to upgrade my graphics drivers to the latest version, which is the thing I didn't do first. And then basically once you've got the game installed, you get rid of the wine prefix, which is the directory that sort of wine installs its C drive into, if you like, and then you run wine tricks to install some dependencies and tell it to pretend to be Windows 7. And once you do that, you run the game and it works.
And wine tricks is interesting because you normally run that like outside of Steam. You might run that on a normal system. Does it not? Like, doesn't Steam and Proton have its own wine prefix? Do you have to like tell wine tricks, install it over there in that special C drive, or does
exactly? Oh, yes. Okay. So I think each game has its own wine prefix. So there's a directory in the .steam folder in your home directory. Then there's a compatibility layer folder, and then there's like all of the IDs of the games that use Proton. And then in there's a folder which is the wine prefix. Huh. So you basically tell it to delete that and create a new one. And then you set the wine prefix environment variable and run wine tricks, and it'll do its thing in there.
Nice. And how well does it work?
Perfectly. No problems at all. I mean, I've not played that much. I'm still trying to work out how not to die in the combat training. I'm not very good at it, and the Steam controller controls are a bit cumbersome, so I'm still getting used to how you actually control everything. But no, I mean, yeah, I can't notice anything that doesn't say this is a native game.
Huh, interesting. I've sometimes watched a few YouTube streamers, including Kate Russell from BBC Click and Fabian Scherschel, friend of the show, who plays it quite a lot. And they're both very, very good at it. And I've played it on Windows for about 5 minutes. I think that's my total play time, is about 5 minutes. And I just couldn't get that. But then I couldn't get the hang of Elite on the BBC Micro. So,
no.
Yeah, I just can't control in three dimensions. That I found that really hard.
That landing sequence was impossible as far as I was concerned on the 8-bit computers.
I've played Oolite, which is like an open source clone of Elite, and I got quite good at that. And I have played Frontier quite a bit, but I got wound up by the realistic physics making it really, really hard to play, because flying spacecraft in reality is very difficult.
In reality. You've done much spacecraft flying in reality, Mark.
You know what I mean.
I honestly don't, but okay.
Have you been flying any spacecraft recently, Alan?
No, I've been doing much more complicated things. I've been upgrading hard drives in my computers.
Oh my goodness, not again.
When I say hard drives, I mean SSDs, because...
this is very familiar. Did we talk about this last week?
We did. We got boatloads of feedback about it. I'm already worrying about our inbox quota.
What? Really?
Yeah, you were sorting out your daughter's laptop last season, and it was a multi-episode.
No, this is way easier. This is No, I was upgrading my laptop, and these run Linux, so they're not hard at all. So I've been running out of space on my ThinkPad, so I thought I'd get a bigger hard drive rather than delete stuff, because that's just, you know, easier. And so I bought a terabyte SSD, which is surprisingly cheap these days, to replace the 480 gig one that was in there, and did the old boot from USB live environment with the new drive in a USB caddy, and just used DD Rescue to just copy it over, and then gparted to expand the partition, and then swap the drives over, put the new one inside, and that's it, done. That was it. And then I had a, because that drive, that 480 gig, is actually bigger than most of the drives in the other laptops, I went through a little hand-me-down through my other machines and passed them down. So I did this about three or four times over the last few days. But the one that I couldn't do, the one that I couldn't fathom, maybe this will solicit some feedback, is Samantha's laptop only has a 60 gigabyte SSD, and I wanted to upgrade her to a 240 that I got from one of the other machines. But because she's got a fully encrypted Lux encrypted drive, it was a little bit more complicated. You could do the DD rescue from the internal to the external, but then gparted couldn't expand the partition. I had to use crypt setup to mount the encrypted partition, but even then it wouldn't do it. And I kind of gave up, and I thought, well, I've spent far too much time on this. I'll come back to this another day. But I couldn't quite figure out how to expand an encrypted partition. I followed a couple of guides, but neither of them worked. So if anyone has done that and has a successful guide, I would appreciate the feedback. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, shall we get on with the rest of the show? So I am reliably informed that Mark has a new streaming box. And my first question is, Mark, what is a streaming box?
Okay, this is a term which I might have just invented by the sound of it.
Okay.
This is a box which I plug into my TV in my bedroom, and it lets me stream video from various services.
Right.
Previously, I had a Chromecast for doing this, but the Chromecast died.
I'm so glad you've explained it, because I thought it was something to do with your bathroom. So thank you.
That would be a steaming box.
Insert drums here. So what did you have previous? Is this replacing something you already had, or is this?
Yeah, we had a Chromecast in the bedroom, and we had an old phone which stayed in the bedroom, and if we wanted to watch something on the TV in there, we found it on the phone and beamed it to the Chromecast. Then the Chromecast basically decided it wasn't going to connect to Wi-Fi anymore, and and I got a Raspberry Pi 3A Plus for Christmas, so I thought, I wonder if I can do the same thing with that. Not quite the same thing, but, you know, have it, because it's not going to cast from the phone, but have a box plugged into our TV that connects to the network and streams stuff.
Okay. So where I've dotted Rokus around the house, you have decided to go the DIY route and create a device of your own that does a similar thing.
Yes, because I've done a similar thing in the living room. My Steam box also runs Kodi, and then there's a plugin for that which launches Chrome in kiosk mode, and so that can load the Netflix website and the iPlayer website and things like that.
So when you say you've rolled your own, is this like a ready-made ISO image that you just dump on an SD card and you're done, or did you actually like have to craft things and chisel it out of wood and stuff?
Well, I haven't been like compiling my own kernel, but basically what I thought was, what I've done in the living room isn't going to work, because it basically relies on Chrome and all of the stuff baked into that. But I might be able to do something with Kodi and plugins for Kodi for streaming video that way. So I had a look at what's available by default. I installed Raspbian and installed Kodi and went looking for some plugins, and I found iPlayer and YouTube and installed them, and they seem to work okay. But then I tried playing video, and it wouldn't play. It sort of thought it was playing, and it was showing me the counter, but it didn't work. So I did some Googling, and there was some sort of suggestions about hardware acceleration settings needing to be accelerated and stuff. At which point I thought, well, wait a minute. If anyone's done Kodi right, it's a on the Raspberry Pi, it's a project like LibreOLEC or OSMC, which is an image specifically for running just Kodi and nothing else on these devices.
Right. So you switched to that?
I switched to that. So I
re-imaged the
SD card and installed. I tried OSMC and had a quick look, and then I realized it was Kodi 17, not Kodi 18. So I abandoned that for a reason which will become apparent shortly.
Okay.
And then I switched to LibreOLEC.
Okay. Before we get into LibreOLEC, did you try the Chromium browser on Raspbian to try and play things like Netflix and YouTube at all?
I didn't.
Oh, okay. Because I know that the Chromium browser in Raspbian is accelerated, so it has got, you know, video acceleration in it for YouTube and alike. But what I don't know is if it's got the Widevine modules to do the DRM.
That's what I assumed would be a problem.
Maybe a listener can answer that question for us. So we pick up the story with Mark about to install LibreOLEC.
Yes, so I did that. I used the noob. No, I didn't. I tried using the noobs install image, which is the thing you get from the Raspberry Pi website. That didn't work. It wouldn't boot. So I just found a separate image on the LibreOLEC website and just installed that onto the SD card, and that worked.
Sorry, rewind. Noobs? What's that?
Noobs is an SD card image which you stick on your SD card. In fact, no, you just unzip the files and copy them onto your SD card, and then you stick that in your Raspberry Pi, and it boots up, and it says, here's a load of operating systems for the Raspberry Pi. Which ones would you like installed?
Huh.
And they'll install as a multi-boot thing.
Wow, cunning.
I won't dive into this too much, but instead of noobs, there's a thing called PIN, which is PIN isn't noobs, it's not noobs,
okay.
Which is an enhanced version.
Is it enhanced because it supports Ubuntu Mate by any chance?
It's funny you should say that. Yes, it supports Ubuntu Mate 18.04 and the clever partitioning scheme we have in there now.
I see.
But yeah, I'll come back to that maybe in a later episode.
Interesting.
So you've got the OS installed.
Yes.
And you plug it into your TV and lay back in the bed. And what do you do to make pictures come on my telly?
So I, having got LibreOLEC working, I installed the iPlayer and YouTube plugins again, and they work on LibreOLEC without me having to do anything, which was nice. So then I wanted to see if I get Netflix working, which is, this is where I assumed things would be difficult.
Yeah.
Now, it turns out that Kodi 18 has a new feature called Adaptive Input Stream.
Catchy name, I like
it. Yes, and I tried to find out what this actually is, and I can't really find much information. But basically, it allows plugins to have video streams playing, and it supports Widevine.
Right.
And there are various ways of it supporting Widevine, but one of them, if you're running on a Raspberry Pi, is when it tries to play something, it says, hello, I need to download a Chromium OS recovery image and extract the Widevine DRM module. It also requires some Python crypto libraries underneath, which LibreOLEC already has installed, so there's nothing to do there. And so that spends a long time downloading and extracting a 2 GB image. To get this thing working and puts it in the right place for you.
Such a shame that they can't, like, someone can't just put that somewhere. I realize licensing and all that kind of stuff. And
I was about to say, Google do. I'll have to get in touch with the project, because when I was working with one of the browser vendors, there's a URL that Google publish that has a little, like, JSON file in it.
Yeah.
And you parse that and it says, this is the file that you download if you're on ARM of this instruction set or Intel of this architecture. And you can suck down just a bundle of files, which are the Widevine modules for your appropriate operating system and architecture.
Right. But nobody's going to put a script together that does that, because if they do, Google will just move it, won't they?
No, this is what it's intended for. There was a recent licensing change in the way that this stuff works to enable people that are building off Blink and WebKit-based browsers to have access to that stuff. So, yes, maybe I'll find time to try and point somebody at one of those projects in the right direction.
Cool. So with this Widevine stuff installed, there is a plugin called plugin.video.netflix. Guess what it does for Kodi? Which will let you log into your Netflix account and browse videos and play them using this adaptive input stream feature.
And does it browse the stock Netflix experience?
No, it doesn't bring up the Netflix website. It's like a Kodi media library type menu, but it has all of the headings you'd see on the website. So you start and it has a list of your users, and then you select that and it says recent released, continue playing for whoever, and then whatever categories it would show you on the website show up in Kodi.
Oh, nice. That's pretty clever.
So it's the same content just presented in Kodi's for expression native UI.
Yes, exactly.
Nifty.
I did have a few issues with the version which I found on the sort of lead maintainer's GitHub. It didn't seem to work very well with the Raspberry Pi, and I did some digging around and found a sort of beta release that's in development, which I tried out, and that worked instead, because there's various bugs which seem to keep coming and going with it.
So now that you've got it to the point where it could like play Netflix, and your previous user interface to this was there was a mobile phone that you could use the apps and stream to the Chromecast. What do you do to control this thing from the other end of the room?
So I have a, let me just find what it's called. It is a Re i8 Plus.
A what?
Oh, yeah.
It's basically a little sort of keyboard pad that connects via a wireless dongle.
It's a proper PC keyboard, but small.
Exactly.
Right.
It's also got a touchpad on it and some other extra
buttons. Yes, I have a similar one. Yeah. And it has a little USB key that you plug into the
device.
Right.
So I have that plugged into the Raspberry Pi. And we sit in bed with that in our hand and control it.
Is there any reason you didn't go for like a, in inverted commas, proper remote control, like those Windows Media remote controls, so that it feels like a normal remote control and not like a nerdy keyboard?
Because if I want to type, it's a lot easier. I don't know. Basically, this is what I use downstairs on my living room PC.
Right.
More importantly, because for the living room PC where it opens the browser, it's actually handy to have the mouse pointer, which isn't so necessary on Kodi, but this is what I knew would work well and what we're used to. So I thought I'll just get another one of those.
I'm kind of asking for selfish wifey approval reasons in case I do this. And in the bedroom, there's this like PC keyboard lurking around somewhere rather than just a up, down, left, right fire.
I can give you a solution that has wife acceptance factor.
What's that?
You can also get apps for your phone and your tablets, which are Kodi remotes.
Oh, yes.
And they go over the network, so you can just get a remote on your phone.
I wondered if you were going to say that, Mark, because I think it's probably prudent not to rely on a phone, personally. I'd rather it was a remote control, so it has that traditional, it's a box under the telly, where's the remote for that box? Oh, I've got to go and get my phone to be able to use this thing, and it means that the phone has to stay in the bedroom in order to be able to use the thing.
And not run out of battery.
Yeah, and that's and also sometimes the phones lose context of where they are, and you've got to relaunch the app and all that kind of stuff. So interesting that you're using a keyboard.
This was a big problem we had with the previous solution.
Right. I've got an old Windows. I'm tempted to do this myself because I have an old Windows Media remote, like one of those infrared ones that comes with a USB infrared thing. I think I might give it a go.
I think all of that would work with this solution based on what I've read.
Nice.
In summary, then, you've built this thing. Are you happy with it? Would you recommend other people give this a try? Is this, you know, a usable day-to-day device?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. I was a bit, it took some getting there. But now that I've got there, now that I've used LibreElec and things just work with LibreElec, I'm actually very happy with it as a solution. And we haven't, my initial, like, I sort of had a build that was plugged in and we were using with Raspbian, but it was flaky and I was nervous every time we turned it on that we wouldn't actually be able to do anything with it. But now it seems pretty solid and we've been watching stuff with it and it's really good.
So no buffering or, you know, dropouts or anything like that, or just
haven't noticed anything like that.
Brilliant.
You said every time I turn it on, it's not a thing you would leave on. You like turn it off and on again or?
We shut it down. It's plugged into a multi-plug, which the TV is also plugged into, and there's a button on that to turn it on and off. So because, you know, to reboot it, you'd have to unplug and replug it otherwise. So we just turn that on. Before, I had the Chromecast plugged into that because I didn't want the Chromecast sitting on my network all the time.
Right. Mm-hmm. So my Chromecast is plugged into the USB port on the telly. So when I turn the telly on, the Chromecast comes on. I guess I don't know if a TV would have enough oomph to power.
I don't think Raspberry it does. Pi. No, yeah. I ended up getting the official power adapter for the Raspberry Pi because it needs like 2.5 amps for the 3 plus.
Good point.
I bought some new 3-amp power supplies for Raspberry Pis recently that have clickable power switches in the cable.
Oh, that's nice. Yes.
Yeah, it's the height of luxury, that is. I love it.
One thing I would say about this, if I was starting from scratch, I would go with a 3B plus rather than a 3A plus just because...
more RAM.
Well, no, that doesn't seem to be an issue, actually. It's the ports.
Oh, right.
Because I've ended up sticking because I need to use the USB port for the dongle for the keyboard, but right. I've ended up sticking a hub which also has an Ethernet USB adapter in it. So really, right. I could have done with a 3B plus, which just had the Ethernet port and extra USB ports if I needed them.
Well, thanks for explaining that. I'm really quite taken with the idea. We started out with the Raspberry Pis when the Raspberry Pis were young. The first Raspberry Pi project I did was a Kodi front end in the front room to replace some no brand Chinese box. I'd like to have a little tinker with that. So that gives me everything I need to do just to get up and running quickly. Right then, let's move on to some command line love.
If you love the command line as much as we do, send us a command that will blow our minds and we might even mention it on the show. Send your command line love to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
So, Alan, I hear you've been rummaging in the vault of love and you've got some love for us.
I certainly do. I plugged a CD-ROM drive into my laptop.
A what?
Yeah, I know. I dived into the time tunnel and got some of my old... I found I was tidying up a shelf and I found some CDs and they were backups that I've made in the past. And I thought, I wonder what's on those. Before these CDs all rot, I think I should probably read the stuff off them and put them in my backup cycle so that they're, kept. And I had about half a dozen of these backups and some of them have got similar stuff on. Some of them have got, new stuff on. And so I ended up copying every single one of them into a separate folder, date stamp folder. And then I wanted to find all the duplicates because I didn't want to have all the duplicates all over my drive. And so I thought, how do I find duplicates? There must be a program for that on Linux. And sure enough, I found today's command line love, which is rdfind, which is a super little utility that finds duplicate files. So you just run it and point it at a directory. And if you just do that, it will produce a report that tells you a little text file that tells you all the duplicates and how much space you could save if you get rid of the duplicated files. And that's just the default. All it does is just produces a report. But what you can also do is tell it to remove the duplicates. It could just delete them or it could create soft links.
Oh, I love this.
Hard links. So you have one copy of each of the files. It's really very nice. Oh. Very easy, simple to use. Very quick as well. It's interesting when it does the analysis, it initially looks at the sizes of the files. And if two files have a different size, then obviously they're not the same. But then if they have the same size, it just looks at the first byte and the last byte of the file. And if those are the same, then it does an MD5 hash to see if they really are the same. So it's really fast. I mean, I was buzzing through 6 CDs worth of data and it did it in just a few seconds.
This is wicked.
Yeah, it's really, really good. So rdfind, it's in the archive. It's really easy to use, and I highly recommend it.
Lovely. I shall be running that over a photo library at some point in the weekend. Right, let's move on.
We love getting your feedback. If you've got a comment about something you hear on the show, why don't you drop us an email on show@ubuntupodcast.org.
And we do have some feedback even on this second show. So Paul Waring emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
I just accessed the Ubuntu Podcast website using HTTPS, and I've noticed a couple of assets are served over HTTP, causing a mixed content warning and missage image markers in Firefox.
Yes, this is all my fault. I think I said last year this was all my fault, and I think I said last year I would fix this, and as you can plainly see, I have not fixed this, but I will. I was poking around at this a little bit earlier, and I'll get this fixed probably by the time we record again.
We're not going to wait until season 15 or...
Well, yeah, we could. We could see how long browsers will actually accept that kind of thing before they give up entirely. But then again, maybe not. And David Osborne also emailed us.
I've recently installed 18.04 Ubuntu on my crusty old 2009 Mac Mini, and it runs great. It's becoming the go-to family internet machine for school searches, printing, and even some gaming thanks to Steam and Proton. Question, before settling on the LTS release, I tested 18.10, and I was impressed by how snappy GNOME Shell felt. I'd like to stay on the LTS due to the difficulty in getting the Mac hardware to work properly, and I don't want breakages. Will the 18.10 improvements to GNOME trickle down to the LTS?
Unfortunately, no. So, by and large, when we release an LTS, the only updates that you get are security fixes and critical bug fixes. And very occasionally, that might result in a package actually being revved to a new version of a bit of software, if patching or, you know, monkey patching things in is difficult. But you won't get new GNOME on the 18.04 release. So if you want new and shiny, you can ride the interims, the 18.10 and 19.04, or just stick with 18.04 until 20.04 comes round.
But some of the patches, like individual patches, not the entire release of GNOME getting upgraded, but individual patches are being done to 18.04.
Mm-hmm.
True. So you won't get, as Martin says, you won't get the newest, shiniest release of GNOME, but you might get some performance improvements that are done by the Ubuntu desktop team and some that are done by external people that get cherry-picked by the desktop team. I know this because some of the patches that have been submitted upstream to the GNOME project, they've said, oh, that probably won't work. And the desktop team said, yeah, well, we've already landed it in Ubuntu. So, and it does. And we have like quite a wide, diverse set of users who are testing this stuff already for us. And so, yeah, you might find some of it, but probably not all of it will end up there.
And that concludes our feedback for this episode. Well, that was good. I'm going to go and dust off a Raspberry Pi after this and go and have a play.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I'm glad I need to know that I start with LibreELEC now. So whilst the rest of you are dusting off your Raspberry Pis, you can find more Ubuntu podcasts between now and the next show on Twitter at Ubuntu Podcast. And we also have a well-populated Telegram group, which is ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. There's loads of people in there, and we have a chat about the shows and all manner of other Linux and Ubuntu-y open-sourcey stuff. So, until next time.